Good morning and welcome to the House Energy Committee. We'll go ahead and call this meeting to order. The time is 104? 103. On Tuesday, January 27th, members present are Representative Edgman, Representative Kopp, Representative Costello, Co-Chair Representative Mears, and we have in the room also Representative Zach Fields. And I'm Kai Holland, co-chair of the Energy Committee. Thank you all for joining us today. Looking forward to the meeting that we have planned, and I appreciate all the work that's gone in. Those of you that were able to attend, particularly with the weather, and the folks that have done all the work to prepare for the presentations. Let's see, I'd like to remind members, please silence your cell phones. Also note that we're allowing the use of electronic devices during committee meetings. Just a reminder that staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Tim Truer, who's up here, and help you out. I'd like to recognize that Representative Ruffridge has joined us. Continuing, and importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the House Energy Committee Secretary over here, who has been with us for a while and knows an incredibly a large amount about all these issues now. Zach Lawhorn and Jude Augustine in the back from the LIO were providing support for the technology and teleconferencing support that we'll rely on today. Thank you for that. As we begin the meeting today, the first item of business before the committee is going to be a presentation of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska on rail belt gas import facilities. Last year, the committee posed a question to the RCA, what statutory changes might ensure that the RCA takes a more holistic approach? This was in regards to our concern about the potential of multiple large energy projects developing in the Cook Inlet area, including, in this case, LNG, which will be a significant focus today. But it also comes about because of a concern about how do we think about managing many large energy projects that in some cases could be providing overlapping energy, and yet all of these projects come at the cost of the ratepayers, who ultimately are funding everything that we do, particularly in a co-op model. And this not only affects our rail belt rate players, but it is the rail belt cost of energy that then is also the floor for our PCE calculations and our support for our rural energy users too. So this is important for us to understand how do we manage the costs of energy and manage the flow of all the projects to the benefit of all Alaskans. But certainly there's been a concern about the availability of gas for South Central and our power generation. It was only a year ago that we were seeing a lot of concerns about, did we have enough gas? How would we bridge to some long-term solution, a gas pipeline or other options? I think today we're seeing that with the hard work done by the utilities and the gas suppliers, that supply issue, particularly assisted with storage, no longer is quite the dire situation it was a year, 18 months ago, yet nonetheless, we need to give it attention. So back to trying to stay closer to script. Today, though, we'll be looking at some of these developments in a little more detail and have an opportunity both to get updates as well as have a chance to talk about some questions. In terms of the format, I think our intent here is to have the first presentation by the RCA and take some questions at that point with the presenters, and then we're going to move on to some presentations with Harvest Midstream and NSTAR. The intent there will be to have those initial presentations by Harvest and Midstream and any clarifying questions. What we're really hoping to do, though, is then bring them back up to the table together for a deeper conversation and questions at that point. So just kind of to think about that flow of questions on there. So back to where we're going to start off with the RCA here. RCA Chair John Espindola, Commissioner Steve DeVries will be presenting for the RCA. And if you'd please introduce yourselves for the record, you can begin your remarks. I understand Ms. Claire Knudsen-Lotta and Ms. Julie Volger are also available for answering questions. And a reminder to everyone to introduce yourselves as we continue forward with that. So if we can begin with the RCA presentation, Mr. Espindola, and are you there online and ready for us?
Yes. Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing the Regulatory Commission of Alaska the opportunity to participate in this committee hearing. For the record, my name is John Espindola, Chair of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. On the line with me is Commissioner Steve DeVries, Utility Master Analyst Julie Vogler, and Utility Engineering Analyst Claire Knutson-Lotta. We are here today to respond to a question from the committee. The question posed to us was, what authority the RCA has to reduce the risk to consumers if multiple gas import facilities are constructed? We addressed this question in part in an order we issued last year. That order is U25004, order number 5, which was also discussed with this committee. As we noted in that order, under the Natural Gas Act, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has exclusive jurisdiction over the siting, construction, expansion, or operation of an LNG import facility used in either foreign or interstate commerce. Please refer to page 29 of that order. Because we lack jurisdiction over an LNG import facility, we lack the authority to assess whether a duplication of LNG import facilities would be contrary to the public interest under AS 4205-221-D, also noted in page 31 of that order, footnote 128. However, while we lack the jurisdiction over the LNG facility, we do have jurisdiction over gas supply agreements and terminal use agreements used to supply gas to consumers. Please refer to pages 34 and 35 of that order. Our authority to review gas supply agreements and express scope of that review authority is delineated at AS 4205-141-D. We will stay online for the committee to ask us questions throughout and after the presentation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Are there any questions to begin with? Yes, Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you through the chair to Chair Espindola. So our thoughts here are that we might have two facilities that are asking for approval that might not happen at the same time. It's our understanding from previous conversations that the RCA has only been limiting itself to looking at the dockets and the requests that it has in front of us. Does the RCA have the ability to open another docket to take up the matter of how to address duplicative facilities, and what would happen to consumer rates if there was an overbuilding of infrastructure?
Chair Mears, Reese, I'm a commissioner with the Regulatory Commission. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So your question about whether or not we have the authority to review the duplication of facilities, I believe, is one that Chair Espindola just spoke to. That's exclusive FERC jurisdiction. So we don't have the authority to question or to interject ourselves into the question of the duplication of LNG import facilities. I hope that answered your question. If not, I'd be happy to follow up if you want to clarify.
Thank you. I'll follow up on that. So the commission has the ability or has the responsibility to approve contracts. If you're approving contracts for a gas supply agreement that has embedded costs for a new facility, what happens if another facility comes along that is asking for a reimbursement for capital costs that would increase rates to the customer?
Chair Mears, Steve DeVries again for the record. We would review those costs in the context typically either of a rate case where those costs were presented to us, or in review or approve of a request for approval of a gas supply agreement source of gas to consumers. That would be within our jurisdiction.
Follow up,
please.
So through the chair to Mr. DeVries, if you are evaluating a second contract that a gas supply contract that included costs for a duplicative facility, is it within the RCA's ability to deny the reimbursement of those costs?
if Chair Mears, Steve DeVries for the record, yes, we could if the costs were imprudently incurred. That would be a subject that could be reviewed by the commission if it was raised as an issue of dispute.
Follow up?
Yeah, please.
Thank you through the chair to Mr. DeVries. So the way things are set up now, if this situation were to occur, the RCA doesn't have the ability to weigh in until somebody had already signed contracts and was on the path of building a secondary facility, a second facility.
Chair Mears, to the extent that that was a question, we wouldn't be reviewing that until it was presented to us for review in conjunction with a request for costs to be included in rates.
Thank you. Can I make a final comment?
Sure.
Thank you. So it seems like the tools we have in front of us, and we'll continue to look into it, don't put the state of Alaska in the position of keeping the private sector from overbuilding facilities and passing costs on to consumers. Thank you.
Other questions?
It was a comment, but I'm gonna hold it.
Yeah. Well, if I can, then I'd like to follow up on this issue because I want to take it, I think, back to the question we asked a year ago. And I don't know if this is for Chair Espindola or could be the commissioner. What statutory authority changes might ensure that we could take a more holistic view of these multiple projects, particularly as we start looking at not only the overlay of potentially multiple LNG projects, but we could have multiple gas storage projects and gas supply agreements. There's a layering here of different activities, and it seems like we have created a structure that allows us to silo each one of those decisions for prudent review of that decision siloed, but not the ability to look more broadly. Is there a statutory authority that might help RCA in fulfilling a mission of ensuring that the rates that we're paying long-term are the most economical and we're getting the best value out of what will end up being the rates that we pay?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Holland, this is John Espindola for the record. We did discuss this at a public meeting last February, and we do feel we have the statutory authority that we need to take care of what comes in front of us. I think the nuance here with this particular issue is that we're dealing with the federal regulatory entity, which supersedes our authority. We are anxious to hear these two presentations in front of us that may shed more light, but like this body, we only know what's been provided publicly. And so as the presentations take place today, you are welcome to ask us more of these questions throughout.
Great. Thank you. And to follow up on that, could you clarify for me, we've heard repeatedly that the FERC jurisdiction preempts any RCA jurisdiction on these projects. Is that holistic in terms of FERC not only approves the siting, the construction, the operation of the facilities, but are you suggesting that they also oversee the contracts that are associated with their use, the rates that would be generated from them? It sounds like maybe we're ascribing to FERC more than they might do beyond their facility scope of work, that there is actually perhaps an overlay where RCA does have some involvement with these facilities that go beyond FERC's initial licensing and authorization for this facility. Could you clarify for me where the line is between what FERC is responsible for managing and where it crosses over into the regulatory environment where RCA does have any authority with these import facilities?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Holland, this is Commissioner Steve DeVries. while the FERC has the jurisdictional authority, exclusive jurisdictional authority over the site and construction operation of an LNG import facility, where that facility is has a facility use agreement with a LDC, local distribution company, that's providing gas supply services to consumers within the state, and that gas supply agreement and a facility or terminal use agreement that utility might have with the operator or owner of the LNG facility, the costs associated with that are sought to be flowed through to consumers would be within our jurisdiction. That's the dividing line that essentially FERC case law has carved out, where it makes it clear where a state commission such as ours has the jurisdictional authority to regulate rates that impact consumers on an intrastate basis, which is where we are. I hope that's answered your question. If it hasn't, I'd be happy to follow up.
Yes, Representative Klopp.
Yes, thank you, Chair Hollander. I think it's important to realize that the private sector, I can't imagine, has any interest in overbuilding facilities competitive to see which one goes forward. They do have an interest in, and I believe FERC, they've made it clear, has the say on which one goes. I can't imagine them permitting two import facilities that are a mile apart. Only one is going to be competitive, and so ultimately we're only going to have one, and we have entities that are making their best cases as which one is the best interest for ratepayers.
Yes, Representative.
Thanks. I'd like to make a comment on that. I appreciate that perspective, Representative Kopp, but I believe we're looking at two facilities that are looking to modify existing FERC permits. That nobody's applying for anything from scratch, but we will get to that here very shortly and clarify that. But thank you for that perspective.
Any other questions at this point for the presenters from the RCA? Okay, hearing none, then thank you for the presentation. I hope that you can stay on the line in case there are additional questions that may come up that you could help us with through the course of the discussion. Next, we'll hear a presentation from Sean Kolarsa, president of Harvest Midstream. I ask committee members to keep their questions fairly brief for clarifying questions at this point. We'll have time for additional questions after the next presentation. Mr. Kolarsa, please approach the bench, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Mears, Holland, and distinguished members of the House Energy Committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here to testify today. For the record, my name is Sean Kolarsa. I am the president of Harvest Midstream. And again, really appreciate the opportunity to be here representing the Harvest team and our role in supporting Alaska energy infrastructure. I'm here today to provide an update on Harvest, our ongoing operations across the state, as well as an update on the proposed LNG import facility at Nikiski and how this project fits into Alaska's near and long-term energy reliability needs. Thank you again for inviting me today. With that, let's start out with slide 2. Now, I know that many of you are more familiar with the producers and the utility customers, you know, within the state. Really want to spend some time before getting into the specifics of the project to spend a few minutes providing context on who Harvest is and how we operate. Harvest is an American energy infrastructure company. We were founded in 1993. Our sole focus is on developing, constructing, acquiring, owning, and operating critical energy infrastructure that moves energy safely and reliably from where it's being produced to where it's needed. Simply put, we don't drill oil and gas wells and we don't sell gasoline at the pump. You know, our interest really is, and our role is, the infrastructure in between. The pipes, the plants, and terminals, LNG facilities, and any other infrastructure that make the rest of the system work. Harvest is really the only midstream-focused company operating here in Alaska. Today, Harvest owns and operates infrastructure, as you can see on the map, across 8 states, and we have that organized into 6 regional business units. Each of those regional businesses are led by a vice president with teams that understand the customer needs, the customer base, operating conditions, and the regulatory environment that is specific to that geography. Across those regions, our assets span commodities and the full midstream value chain. That includes gathering, processing, and treating natural gas, separating and fractionating natural gas liquids, transporting oil and condensate, and producing LNG, including facilities that we have in Colorado, as well as the North Slope of Alaska. Now, in terms of Harvest, we do have common ownership with Hilcorp, but we are a very distinct and separate company. We do have a commercial relationship. You know, Hilcorp's a key customer within the state. Also do some business with them in our Four Corners region, New Mexico, Colorado. But, you know, across the rest of our footprint, we are a separate company with our own employees, our own management team, governance, and balance sheet. And the majority of our business involves services to a broad set of third-party customers. From a financial standpoint, Harvest has its own bank credit facilities, including a term loan, a revolving credit facility, as well as several tranches of public bond debt, which reflects really how we're evaluated. At the end of the day, it's based on Harvest assets, our cash flows, and our operating performance. Across our company, you can see on the table, we employ 650 people, of which 62 are in the state of Alaska. We're very proud of the employees we have that live here, work here, and have been part of Alaska's energy system for years. I wanted to start here because the project that I'll be discussing today really builds directly on this operating foundation, particularly our experience owning and managing long-lived critical energy infrastructure, and specifically in Alaska. Now that I've given some background on Harvest overall, let's turn to slide 3, where I want to spend a few minutes walking through our operations here in Alaska. Alaska is a very meaningful part of our overall business. It's where we operate some of our most critical infrastructure. Harvest has been operating in Alaska for over 15 years, with assets both on the North Slope and in the Cook Inlet. And we've grown that presence over time through a combination of acquisitions as well as targeted growth projects. On the North Slope, we own and operate approximately 156 miles of crude and condensate pipelines. These assets were acquired from BP in 2014 and again in 2020. These pipelines are part of a critical physical system that moves oil from the producing fields into the Trans-Alaska pipeline system and ultimately serves predominantly refineries on the West Coast. Now, that role may sound very straightforward, but requires operating reliably in Arctic conditions, coordinating with producers, and maintaining assets that are essential to the broader system. We also have placed our North Slope LNG facility into service in December of 2025, adding to our existing North Slope operations. Harvest also holds a 49% interest in the Trans-Alaska pipeline system, and you know that is a core piece of Alaska's energy infrastructure operated by Alyeska in coordination and governance provided by and among the owners. In the Cook Inlet, we own and operate over 225 miles of natural gas pipelines, supplying critical gas to utilities throughout the region. We also operate approximately 73 miles of oil pipelines that supply crude oil to the Kenai refinery. Our Cook Inlet pipeline system, Harvest Alaska, completed the Cross Inlet Pipeline Project in 2018. That was a project that really reconfigured the existing infrastructure that we had, and it added a subsea pipeline segment that allowed crude to be moved across the inlet by pipeline rather than by tanker traffic. So that really removed the risk of operations at Drift River and the tanker movements from the Chrissie Lee platform. This was a project that had been discussed for years by multiple parties, and Harvest was really proud to partner with our customers and work with regulators to gain approval for the project. The result was improved operational safety and reliability that was achieved through targeted additions and modifications to existing infrastructure. Across Alaska, our focus has been consistently on safe, reliable operations and long-term stewardship of essential infrastructure. So turning next to slide 4, I want to continue the discussion with a recent Harvest Alaska project that helps provide reliable gas supply into the interior of Alaska. Harvest North Slope LNG facility is the first project to commercialize natural gas off the North Slope, providing a new reliable source of gas to serve the interior of Alaska. The scope included power generation, gas treating, liquefaction, and truck loading systems, and the execution required coordination with our customer, IGU, multiple engineering and construction firms, including local firms. NANO was a key construction partner to us, providing Alaska-based expertise in the core of execution on this project. The project progressed from commercial agreements to first LNG in under 36 months. Commissioning was completed on December 1st, and the facility is operating and serving customers today. This project really underscores our focus as a company on developing solutions to Alaska's gas supply challenges that work for customers in different parts of the state. Next, to frame the discussion around Kenai, I think it's helpful to start with the planning outlook for gas supply and demand in South Central Alaska, shown on slide 5. So this chart reflects Cook Inlet gas supply and demand forecast developed by the Alaska Utilities Working Group and published in June of 2023. Key takeaway is that the overall market demand in South Central Alaska remains relatively stable at about 70 BCF per year. There's no spike in demand that is driving this picture. What changes over time is the supply. Even with continued development, Cook Inlet production declines steadily as we move into the latter part of this decade. As a result, the region transitions from a balanced market to a structural supply shortfall, not suddenly, but very predictably. That forecasted gap is what has prompted us to begin advancing a potential LNG import solution to address the needs going forward. Our project provides speed, certainty, but also flexibility that I'll get into in the next few charts. Providing a low-cost, phased approach, we believe, is a critical element that I'll highlight as we go through more description of the project. This provides South Central Alaska with the flexibility to be responsive to the changes in this forecast to either accommodate additional local development or further import needs. So with that supply outlook in mind, I want to turn to slide 6 and cover the Kenai LNG site itself. Excuse and how me. We're thinking.
Yeah, just a second. I think before continuing on, I was debating because I know we want to hold some of the questions towards later, but I just feel like if you could back up one slide.
Sure.
Or continuing on, because we're kind of anchoring on in on this being the production demand view of things. And you noted this was a June 2023 forecast that's cited there. It seems that in recent hearings and presentations, we've seen some pretty significant updates to this supply gap analysis that show that the gap right now begins sometime, I believe, around 2030 or 2031 as a combination of the success with some of the drilling activities, the increased use of storage, and some of the new producers that are coming online. And I wonder if you could comment on the characterization of this production demand supply deficit, because I think we're kind of painting a picture here that I'm not quite sure if this is the picture from the harvest view of what harvest can supply and the demand that you have with your contracts, or is there a little more we should say about the more holistic view of the Alaska gas market supply and demand situation? Could you clarify this slide with regards to what we've seen like in House Resources last week?
Yes, to the chair, my response is really a couple things. One, we don't sell any of the natural gas to any of the utilities. So any contracts to anybody that's currently being provided is not by Harvest. Our focus is on infrastructure. And, you know, really, as I mentioned, you know, getting out of this slide, moving to the next one was we recognize this is a point in time and there's going to be a lot of different things that are going to happen. There's going to be new supply development potentially. Or as we go into the future, you might see declines happen more rapidly. And really setting the stage for our project, which can be very flexible in terms of how much that supply shortage is and how we need to fill that. And I'll go into those details as we start working through the specifics.
Okay, let's continue on. Thank you for taking the interruption.
All right, so thank you. And, you know, so really just going through the site itself and how we're thinking about using existing infrastructure to really address the needs that exist. The Kenai site, which we acquired in 2025, is summarized here. The site sits on over 100 acres of industrial land, as highlighted with, you know, in red, providing a very large footprint. With the flexibility to accommodate any additional infrastructure that ultimately may be needed. It's an existing LNG facility with a long operating history as a large export facility that's currently idled. The site includes LNG storage, marine access, pipeline connectivity that were all designed, again, for large-scale LNG operations. Importantly, this site is already pipeline connected into the regional gas system and directly to the Kenai refinery. Our proposal is to repurpose this site to enable LNG imports. The project would reuse existing equipment where appropriate and make targeted upgrades to allow LNG to be received, vaporized, and delivered into the local gas system. What makes this project very cost efficient is the ability to utilize the existing footprint and infrastructure, and specifically dock and tankage. While the project is focused on serving in-state demand, the site also preserves optionality to be part of export solutions if a North Slope gas pipeline is ultimately developed. So next, on slide 7, we think this timeline is useful because it really shows the Kenai LNG site is long-standing energy infrastructure with an existing regulatory foundation that Harvest is building on. This site has been part of Alaska's energy infrastructure since it was originally developed and began operations in 1969. Over its operating life, the facility was owned and operated by major energy companies and remained subject to federal and state regulatory oversight throughout. Exports ceased through the facility just over a decade ago as Cook Inlet gas supplies declined, and the facility was placed into warm idle rather than being decommissioned. As part of that transition, Marathon initiated the regulatory pathway to allow LNG imports. On February 7th, we announced an agreement to assess the feasibility of the redevelopment of the Kenai LNG facility. And really, we entered this phase with probably the same questions that many of you have, and that is, what is the condition of the site and the facilities? And that was a key reason that we entered into this due diligence process. We brought in experts and, you know, to come in and inspect and vet the facilities, and we found that it was very well maintained and very well positioned for LNG imports. We completed that analysis, and on November 11th of 2025, we announced that we had acquired the Kenai LNG facility. So this was another milestone for us in developing a project, putting existing LNG infrastructure back to work to meet South Central Alaska's near-term gas needs and strengthen long-term energy reliability for the state. Now, import capacity really is defined through amendments to existing authorizations, including a FERC import authorization and U.S. Coast Guard waterway suitability assessment. We've now filed necessary applications to advance the project. With that foundation in place, I'll turn to the defined scope of work of what we're proposing at Kenai.
Yeah, and we have a question, Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, just a clarifying. So for the FERC amendment, I recall that was in the news just earlier this month that that application had been made. I haven't done any work with FERC, so I don't know what their timeframes are for things. Do you have an idea of how long that process will be?
Yes, we anticipate somewhere in the order of 6 months, and I'll talk about that some more as I get to the overall project timeline.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question from Representative Cassell.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here. Does your application with FERC also include an eventual export activity? And if so, could you talk about that?
Through the chair? No, it does not. It contemplates imports.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Turning to slide 8, really want to provide an overview first of the scope of the overall process, just to walk it through. And so if you look at the map, LNG tankers would come in to what's listed as number 1, and it'll attach into items number 2 and 3. So that's where the LNG tanker will come in. And then LNG will be pumped from the vessel into the storage tanks. It'll go through the 3 existing storage tanks that we have. It'll go through new vaporizers that are highlighted at item 6, take LNG from liquid to gaseous form, and then the gas gets compressed and put into the existing pipeline interconnections and ultimately be transported down the pipeline network to underground storage facilities. This slide summarizes the defined scope of the regasification project in total that we're proposing at Kenai. As I stated earlier, we are pursuing a permitted capacity of approximately 20 BCF per year. That is sufficiently sized to address near-term supply needs in South Central Alaska. However, the facilities we'll be putting in will have a physical capacity of up to 73 BCF per year. On the marine side, the work that we have is focused on upgrading existing infrastructure, reinforcing the breasting and mooring dolphins, adding the limited new mooring capability, and upgrading marine loading arms. Those upgrades support vessel operations with current common LNG vessel sizing. In order to maintain shoreline stability and safe marine operations, we're reinforcing and extending a shoreline bulkhead in very targeted areas. Onshore, the scope includes installing LNG vaporizers and compression, along with modernizing control systems and ensuring that we've got those pieces in place, and specifically monitoring and safety systems. All work occurs within an established industrial footprint, and notably, no new LNG tanks are required for the initial design. Now, Harvest has already spent millions of dollars on front-end engineering design, utilizing select experts, getting material and construction quotes, as well as lead times, all at our expense and risk to define the scope and the overall project timeline. Our overall project will cost between about $300 to $350 million of total capital. We're continuing to work forward to finalize some of the details as we work to a final investment decision that will tighten the overall final capital cost within this range. I want to emphasize a couple of things here. One is cost efficiency and the flexibility in our proposal. This represents the most capital-efficient, flexible option to adapt to the demand requirements. We can expand our level of imports via filing for an amendment with FERC and a new waterway suitability assessment with the Coast Guard. Longer term, if the demand rises to the total rail belt needs, we would add additional tank and also look at some of the other infrastructure for redundancy. Also, we are maintaining flexibility for this site to be used in the future if necessary as part of an export solution. The facility was an export facility, and that equipment will be bypassed but remain on site. Next, turning to slide 9, this slide summarizes the overall project timeline and highlights why Kenai LNG provides speed and certainty in addressing the near-term gas supply needs. The ability to repurpose an existing LNG facility allows us to move faster with lower execution risk. The project is scoped to function either as a temporary or a long-term solution for rail belt gas needs, depending on how supply options evolve. Upfront capital is minimized to preserve flexibility as these market conditions change, including changes in local production and potential development of a North Slope gas line. Kenai LNG is already a FERC-authorized facility with a long operating history. Because this project repurposes an existing LNG terminal, FERC granted a waiver of the pre-filing process, allowing the project to advance directly to the amendment review. And you can see here that we're anticipating that to occur in Q3 of this year and get approval for that. That waiver just reflected, again, the determination the project scope is well-defined and appropriate for amendment versus first-time authorization. Both the FERC amendment and the U.S. Coast Guard Waterway Suitability Assessment amendments were filed in early January 2026. We completed feasibility work and initiated FEED activities last year, and again, reemphasize that we have invested our own capital to advance this project, including acquisition and development costs. Based on current assumptions, the project could be operational within 2 years of committing to offtake agreements. So under our current planning assumptions, that supports targeted in-service date in late 2028 of, Q4 of 2028. Okay. Finally, a few concluding comments on slide 10. Number one, Harvest is American Energy Infrastructure Company with a diverse and deep skill set. We've been here in Alaska for 15 years, and we are committed to ensure the safe, reliable, and flexible infrastructure solutions for the state. Our project provides the most cost-efficient entry for solving near-term gas supply shortage in South Central Alaska at $300 to $350 million of total capital. This will enable flexibility to easily expand beyond the initial commitment, and we're also poised to be part of an export solution. And that concludes my prepared remarks.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Kloss. Are there any initial clarifying questions you'd like to ask right now? Yes, Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for the presentation. Of course, I have a million questions, but I'll limit myself. So on the timeline slide, which I believe was right before this on slide 9, FID, do you need to have contracts finalized through the RCA to take FID?
Yes, to the chair, yes, we want to get customer commitments prior to getting to FID.
Follow-up, does that include approval of the contracts by the RCA?
Chair, yes, ultimately we'll need to see approval of those contracts.
Follow-up, yeah. So do you need them prior to FID?
To the chair, ultimately we want to have customer contracts in place to make FID, and that is the predominant thing that we're working towards, and then we'll start spending more meaningful capital on engineering and long lead items.
Thank you. I appreciate that. A couple others?
Yeah. Well, if I can follow up to your question first. And what can you say, and I understand confidentiality is, I'm sure, affecting much of this. What can you say right now about any contracts that have been established that are available for us to understand how much of the current planned import capacity has been committed and what you're working on now?
To the chair, we've advanced a number of those conversations, but we are still finalizing terms and finalizing those with a variety of the utilities.
Fair enough. Thank you. Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. So I appreciate having an idea of a capital number. So I saw on the slide and noted that that's at the 20 BCF level. Mm-hmm. Are you able to share, and you have numbers for what a build out to that 70 to 73 BCF level would be, and if you have costs for what it would take to do export?
Yes, to the chair. For us, ultimately, as I mentioned, the facilities will have the capability of getting up to that 73 BCF per year total. As we move forward, though, it's more towards that 70 BCF level, we'll add another tank. An additional tank is probably order of magnitude, $150 million. We'll then look to see if there's any other redundancy that we need to put in place, such as additional vaporizers, although we already have the capacity for that. So that's a reasonable number to go with.
Thank you. Did you have a capital cost for being able to go the other direction and do export?
To the chair, I do not have a capital number for that right now. We will have all the facilities, again, just bypassed on site, but I do not have a capital number for if we reverse it.
All right, thanks. Representative Castillo, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. And again, thank you for being here. Looking at slide 5, and I don't know what assumptions were made there about the supply deficit, but it looks like it might be possible that the supply deficit occurs before you're scheduled to come online. And I'm thinking maybe this might be a question for somebody else. I know we do have Stingsa and we have storage, but could you talk about the urgency here and how you're meeting that?
Sure. Through the chair. Absolutely. We believe that it's important to create these options as soon as possible, and we are going to be the fastest facility to be able to come online to meet those needs. As referenced earlier, we know that this picture has changed slightly, but we remain ready, and we're the fastest, quickest solution and the most cost efficient to achieve this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And thanks for being here today. Just a couple of questions, just because this is not my realm of expertise always. So at 20 BCF, which is the proposed project in this element, that's the cost I heard at $300 to $350 million. In order to get to what is a projected, and obviously our projections change, as we've already discussed, if you have to implement, let's say up to 60 to 70 or 73, is there more than one storage tank that would be needed or just one? And you said that was 150 million.
Right. Correct. Yeah. Our estimation through the chair, our estimation at this point is that one more tank, you know, ultimately would be sufficient. However, we would look into a variety of different factors such as vessel traffic and accommodating quick offload of the vessels.
Okay, and just a follow-up.
You
know, we hear a lot of horror stories about permitting. It felt like, 6 months to 8 months seems relatively reasonable for FERC, but that seems also like it could be short. Is there some things that I don't know about that could happen, you know, requests for new data, a delay of some sort? I mean, in your experience, are you confident that 6 to 8 months is doable?
Yeah, through the chair. We're very confident on the regulatory timelines. We think that we've provided enough conservatism in the overall estimate, the overall timeline, to be able to accommodate.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Last question I have for a moment before we maybe proceed on to the next presentation, but just to clarify, I assume, but I would like your clarification, that this project is significantly dependent upon additional storage reservoirs being available to be able to operate the facility, that your intent would be a ship comes in, offloads, goes into storage, and then later it's drawn out of storage in order to, I hope, allow you to buy gas when it's the most affordable, and then be able to store it and use it later as we need it. Could you just describe briefly kind of how this project is tied to any sort of storage-related projects and how that layers into the process of reaching any sort of approvals, as well as I assume that may interface in with some of the RCA approval for some of the gas supply contracts. I think storage is another layer in here that's, I think, pretty important to this process, but maybe you could clarify that.
Yes, to the chair, you know, directly. Yes, storage is an important component of this, and that is not something that Harvest is participating in. We do anticipate that between what we've heard in the market from Singsa, you know, Hillcorp, NSTAR, and others, that there will be sufficient storage to accommodate.
Right, thank you. Yes, Representative Mears.
Thank you. I appreciate knowing capital costs, but when we get down to it, customer rates are important. So I assume that will be market purchase of LNG and transportation costs. Can you share what the costs of basically going through the facility are?
Mm-hmm. To the chair, currently going through a process, you know, confidentially working with our customers to negotiate those final terms. So that will be subject ultimately through RCA filings.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Any other clarifying questions right now? Wonderful. Well, thank you, Mr. Klasa, for the presentation. We'll shift now to hearing from John Sims, president of NSTAR Natural Gas Company. Mr. Sims, if you could approach the bench, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your presentation. And again, our hope is that in a few minutes we'll bring Mr. Klasa back up for some continued questions.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is John Sims. I'm the president of NSTAR Natural Gas Company and Singsa. Before I kicked off my presentation, I wanted to address a couple comments I heard from actually the chair and from the commission. Mr. Chair, you made the statement about we're in a better place than we used to be. I think it's really important to understand what that place is. So from gas supply perspective, NSTAR has almost all of its gas under contract in 2026. That is different from prior years where we had all of our gas under contract. The gas that we're receiving to fill that void is interruptible volumes. And that's a really, really important distinction. There's no obligation for the producer or for the utility to take that gas. And so from an obligation to serve perspective, it makes utilities very nervous when we don't have firm obligations in hand. Yes, we have seen an uptick in production, but we have also seen wavering on commitments for what is going to be delivered. So really important distinction. We are by no means out of the woods. And that type of messaging, I think, is really important to restrain. We are not in a good place, full stop. On January 7th, I sent a text to the governor because we had forecasted temperatures of negative 22 in Anchorage. If those temperatures would have materialized, I would not have had the gas to serve my customers, full stop. Luckily, it did not materialize, but if it would have, we would have asked the military to cut back on their consumption, MEA to possibly switch over to diesel. So we are not in a good place. We do not have what we need, and that's why we're going through this exercise. But and it gets worse, right? So 2027, 2028, 2029, 2030. Like, we have a long stretch of really, really challenging conditions, and we need to make sure that we're all communicating that to the general public and that we're working together as utilities, which we are. Addressing one of the comments that was made by the commission, the RCA, and I obviously I have a lot of respect for them, and but I think they're viewing this through the wrong lens and the wrong perspective. Both NSTAR and Chugach Electric have asked the commission to tee this up. And it's not necessarily, can we get approval in rates for these facilities? But it's, let's evaluate these as a commission, as a utility group, and see what makes the most sense for the state of Alaska. They can educate themselves. They absolutely have the power to bring us in, and we can have confidential discussions in the commission. And we've done that before. We did that with Singsa, where the commission walked us through some questions, some very challenging questions, and we looked at ourselves in the mirror and we said, you know what, we probably could do that. And the result of that process is a better utility. The commission has a role. They can absolutely dive in and get educated on this. They got to bring us in. We're trying to do as much as possible from a communication perspective. And again, it's not about approving rates. What Commissioner DeVries said is absolutely true. They can't do that proactively. They have to have a filing in front of them. But that doesn't mean that they can't understand the current dynamics of where we are with the market. So, looking at the slide, I'm going to go kick off here my slides. looking at the title, it's unfortunate what the title says, and it just kind of occurred to me. This says the NSTAR Glenfarn LNG Import Terminal Project. To be very clear, NSTAR is the customer. We have no capital investment. We're not going to make a dime off of this project. This is all about serving our customers. And so it's important to understand that, because a lot of folks have said, well, you're just doing this because you have an opportunity to make a, you know, 11.875, you know, rate of return. And that's the reason why you're promoting that. No, we're promoting this project because after 2 years, $4.6 million of research, analysis, understanding market demand, this was the project that rose to the top. So we have no financial incentive on this. Just a quick system overview for those of you who may not be familiar. That number actually is 3,800 miles. Our ops guys are always trying to be braggadocious about that. But 3,800 miles of pipeline serving over 3,000 square miles. The shaded yellow there represents NSTAR's service territory. So you can see that we serve Willow all the way down to Homer. The green represents APC, which is our pipeline transmission company. We're actually two utilities working underneath one name, which is NSTAR. But that is our transmission service territory. Our customers transport about 60 BCF of gas on an annual basis, 38 BCF in total annual volumes, 156 customers, 156,000 customers. And SINGSA is a critical and important part to how we operate our system. And on January 12th, we filed an application with the commission for additional storage. This would be an NSTAR-owned asset. The question about what does storage look like and whether or not you need it, it is critical and required for LNG import. Have to have it. Touching on just some very, very high-level concepts before we get into the weeds here on the project itself, when you look at what we're calling the Cook Inlet Gateway, we do see that as having lower cost of regasification. An important piece here on, you know, the potential for no stranded infrastructure, and it is aligned with the long-term vision and view of the Alaska energy future. That's one of the main reasons why we picked this project, and we'll get into that a little bit. And then the reliability of gas supply. There's no producer in the market today that can supply NSTAR natural gas, that 38 BCF, the 320 million a day in deliverability that we need. There's no entity in the Cook Inlet that can do that today. So we have to find a solution for that starting in 2033. Yes, Hendricks and Fury has been very bullish on what they can do. It cannot meet all the needs of South Central. And I think, quite honestly, from an operations perspective, one of the values that Hillcorp brings to their to the customers that they serve is they have hundreds of wells. That is not the case with Fury. They have a handful. So when one of those wells goes down, you're losing a significant amount of production. So as a utility, we want to make sure that we have diversity in supplies as well. And that's one of the values that Hillcorp has with the contract that they currently service with today. The concept that we have for our project, I think, has been discussed. And when we went through the evaluation process, we looked at everything. Harvest has been a very reliable operator, both on their pipeline. You can see the positive things that they're doing for the communities of Fairbanks now with that important project that they just got online with IGU. We looked at the possibility. Could we bring down trucks from the North Slope? We quickly realized, one, enormous cost impact for customers. I think they're paying around, $23 per MCF compared to 10 what we're paying, so a massive rate shock. But again, it all goes back to reliability. So I think our estimate was 54 trucks a day would have to come down the haul road in order to meet the needs of our customers. That's not practical. That's not reliable. So when we got down to it, there are some very good options out there. A lot of them, and it was confirmed today, a lot of them are in the $500 million ballpark, right? That project that was just discussed would require about $500 million worth of investment. And similar to the Glenfarn project, about $500 million. When you look at what would be required for long-term contracts, right, that is not a five-year deal that you're making with somebody that invests $500 million. That is a 15, 20, 30-year obligation that the utility has that does not go away. So you're always going to be stuck with that cost of the infrastructure. So from a commercial perspective, if we have the opportunity to spread out those costs over a 30-year term and have the commercial flexibility to roll that directly into a pipeline coming down from the North Slope and take advantage of North Slope gas and Alaska resources. That to me seemed like a no-brainer as opposed to the other option, which is just we're locked in for a long-term contract. We could make that contract shorter, but it's similar to a mortgage. You don't have a five-year mortgage on a brand new home. You have a long one so that it spreads out the cost, right? And so that's what we want to do for our customers is spread out that cost as much as possible so that there isn't that huge impact. And again, the flexibility to commercially, within the same contract, convert that over into an AKLNG option for us. That would require, as we look at this slide here, that would require converting that import facility into an export facility. Is that something can be done? Yes, it can be done, and it happens all over North America. So these are actual projects that originally started out as import terminals and were later converted over to export terminals. So we have plenty of examples on how that can actually be done, and it is very feasible. This is where the rubber meets the road. Ultimately, what is it going to cost the customers? I think one of the things that you're seeing here is demand is key. The volume that goes through the facility is ultimately going to result in the lowest cost possible. So if it were just NSTAR alone, and everyone realizes that NSTAR doesn't necessarily need this until 2033, so we would anticipate volumes coming in 2032 to start meeting that need. 2033, you're looking at $15 gas. What does that makeup look like? It's a combination of the LNG import price, which is that dark purple, the tugs, which we would need, and the terminal cost. If we didn't have the LNG, or let's say cooking lit gas, all of a sudden rebounded, we would still be paying that $3.70 cost at the bottom. We've made that commitment. That's the commitment for the infrastructure. Yes, we could not pay the LNG import price because we wouldn't need the volumes, but it's important to realize that once we head down this path, whether it's the Harvest Project or whether it's the Glen Farm Project, that's the commitment that we've made, and we've instantly increased the price of the commodity here in Lower 48 by adding that infrastructure cost. The price down below, that is the entirety of cooking the demand going through our project. So you can see in 2033, $15.15 is just NSTAR alone. Down below, if you include all of the utilities, $13.52. So the electric utility, because you put them all together and it still doesn't represent the total demand of NSTAR, it has a smaller impact than if NSTAR were to join the project. So if NSTAR were to join the Harvest Project, it would have a significant decrease on rates than what they're currently forecasting today. That's just how the rubber meets the road. It's the same thing with the AKLNG pipeline. Demand matters, volume matters, and same thing with any infrastructure that we build. Volume matters. I'm going to stop here. Any questions on this, or are we going to wait till the end? You can see some of the things. We are still in negotiations. This has not been set, so we felt it was important to be honest and transparent about what we're looking at today, which is why we're showing these. There is an inflation obviously baked into that, which is why you're seeing the prices increase. But that point is still being negotiated. So there it is. That's where the rubber meets the road. It's important to understand, from my perspective, based on $4.6 million worth of studies over the last couple of years, there is no project, and it's really important that we're honest about this with ratepayers. There's no project, whether it's Cook Inlet, LNG import, that is going to reduce the cost of energy. There's no renewable project that is going to reduce the cost of energy. All of these things have to go on top of existing rates. And utilities have gotten really very good at diverting, right? So you're going to hear a lot about cost savings. Well, this is a cost savings compared to what it would have been. I want to know what the rate impact is going to be. Anytime you hear someone say, what's the cost savings, flip that around and say, what is the rate impact? Because the two answers can be very, very different. And so there's one project out there. I know there's a lot of skepticism, but there's only one that has the potential to reduce the cost of energy, and that is the AKLNG project in the full export model. That's an important piece to understand. This committee asked some very specific questions, so I wanted to make sure we address those. The project description, which includes the import capacity, this project is designed for 300 million a day. That is 109 BCF. So we have significant room for growth here. One of the things that NSTAR is very, very good at, I've been working at this utility for 20 years, 60 years in operation. We are long-term planners. You want to do something once, because the moment you have to add on, expand, there's an additional cost for turning dirt and for making modifications and making changes. So if you have the planning in place, you can reduce the cost to your customer by doing it the first time. A tank may cost $150 million today. What is it going to be in 2032 when NSTAR needs it? Those are important questions. That's why you do something all at once, because you can do it at one time, minimize cost. We look at things that we could have done in the past. We had a project for Singza where we wanted to drill two additional wells. We wanted to add some dehydration, some compression. It got rejected by the commission. As you all know, we had a well sand in. We did the project the next year, and the project cost almost doubled just a couple years later. So we are very good at planning. We're very good at forecasting impacts to rates, and that's why we have one of the lowest distribution costs in the nation, full stop. Do things early so you can take advantage of the costs. Storage, we've talked a lot about storage. We're currently looking at the FSRU versus an option to build an LNG tank on the facility there. That's part of the discussion, part of the negotiation. We'll see what the best cost is for customers and whether or not operationally we can manage as it's designed. I think we've touched on this before. Number three, the assessment of our project's ability to meet all the rail belt's needs. Yes, it can. No question, full stop, pretty easily. How would this function, presuming there's not a gas line developed? This would maintain its operational status as an import facility. The difference is we've got a long-term contract spreading those rates out over time, so the impact, again, to customers is less, with the optionality, if it comes along, to switch over to the AKLNG project. You look at the forecast on question number five with declining production. Would this project come on quick enough to meet the needs? We're anticipating, and based on some contracts we've seen, we're anticipating the gas demand will be met through 2029. MEA just made an announcement here that they've extended their contract with Hilcorp, which we're extremely supportive of. So we believe this project can come online if necessary. If a gas line is developed, how would this project integrate, respond? This goes back to the what happens to the infrastructure. So if you think about project financing, you've got a $500 million investment that requires long-term contracts and a certain amount of debt, right? Somebody's providing that debt. So the pipeline project, again, commercial flexibility, can come in, take on that debt so that we don't continue to have that terminal cost going out for 30 years. It's taken on by the LNG, AKLNG project that then turns into costs that are borne by those exporting. So right away, once that happens, the costs are eliminated from the ratepayer, which is a benefit. That flexibility does not exist in the other option, which is the harvest option, which again is why we chose this.
And
one last thing on this slide. This picture was taken by a service tech of ours that I want to make sure he gets credit for in case he's watching. Beautiful picture that we use all the time now. So thank you again for the opportunity. I went through that relatively quick so that, you know, hopefully we can get some questions from the committee.
Yeah, very good. Well, let's start off with any clarifying questions specifically with Mr. Sims and NSTAR, and then we're going to bring back up Mr. Colossa and have some continued discussion. But I had Co-Chair Mears first, and then Representative Ruffert, who got you next in the queue.
Thank you, through the chair. Just some clarifying points on the previous slide. Just for clarification, FSU floating storage unit?
Yes, thank you.
And I didn't pull out my calculator to do the math, but in box number one, up to 300 MMCFD conversion for how much for a year?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, that is 109 BCF per year is what that brings on.
Thank you. I'm sure you do that math more often than I do. And I'm, despite being an engineer off and off, by a factor of 10. So.
Good there?
I'm all set, yes. Thank you.
Okay, good. And then Representative Kopp, I had you in the queue also, but Representative Ruffridge, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Sims, thanks for being here today. I guess I'm going to go back to the very first title slide, the one that you said was maybe not aptly named. Describe to me, you said you are the customer, so I'm assuming NSTAR is not putting up the capital for this project, and then, but you're here doing the presentation. Walk me through that.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, that's a great question. And starts putting in $0 to this project. What we are working on with Glenfarne is a gas sales agreement. Again, going back to the role of the commission, we feel it's critical and important that the commission play a role in this. So we will be filing it with the concept that they have ultimate authority to approve or reject it, because that is a critical component to all of this. I was asked to present, so I am here. I think, you know, Glenfarne, if they wanted to talk about this, they would be happy to. But I'm also probably more apt to talk about this from a decision-making perspective on why we chose this as opposed to some of the other options out there. So I think that's helpful for this committee to understand. And they wouldn't have been able to release those prices without my authority. I think it's important that people see what the potential rates are.
Just a couple follow-ups,
if follow-up, you may,
Mr. Chair. Thanks. So by saying we chose this, essentially saying there was maybe a couple of different options presented to you as a customer, and you chose this option as a customer, I think that's – am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, that is absolutely correct.
Okay. So as a customer, is this – potential infrastructure, is this what Glenfarne is producing in their presentations as part of phase two, is what they call it, or something separate?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, so I think these two projects are working concurrently. So when they talk about phase one, phase two, they're strictly talking about the AKLNG export project. You don't hear a lot in the public about the import project. And so that is not considered as part of the phase two, with the exception of if the project goes forward and we, you know, decide to enter into an agreement with them and they start building the import facility, then phase two absolutely would be a part of that project, where it would be taking on that debt, acquiring the existing infrastructure that had been built and turning it around.
Final question, Mr. Chair. So moving forward to slide five, which is the estimated price or MCF delivered to NSTAR system. Again, everything is in flux, but some of the estimates that I've seen for initial supply of domestic gas from a pipeline are more than these dollars on this screen. So let's say we build a pipeline. Why would we start using that gas if it's cheaper to import it?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I think that's a great question. And there's no doubt, pipeline gas, if it's just Alaska customers using it, it will be more expensive than the final product. At that point, it really comes down to commercial negotiations. We're still in that process. My desire and my sort of mission in all of this is long-term reliable gas supply at the cheapest cost possible. So the contracts that we're looking at to enter into will provide that opportunity for Alaskans. If you look at the trajectory of the LNG import, it starts out at the 1450, 1480, but it's gradually going up, right? And so, again, it's about long-term reliability. We have made a lot of decisions as utilities and even at the commission level, that have looked at rates from a short-term perspective. And particularly, I can remember 2006 when the commission rejected a number of contracts that we had negotiated for long-term gas supplies. And in the short term, they absolutely would have increased the cost to customers. Hindsight is 2020. It turns out it would have reduced the cost over the long term by billions. And so we need to be careful about looking at short-term ramifications. And we should always be thinking about what is the long-term objective for the state of Alaska and for customers. And ours is always, over the long term, what is the trajectory of rates?
Well, that brings me to one final follow-up.
Okay.
Bad habits. You mentioned a half a billion dollars a couple of times in your presentation. Is that what you think it costs to build this, or is that a better question for Glenfarne? In my reading about these projects, it seemed like the Glenfarne option was quite a bit more than a half a billion.
Yes.
Do you have an estimate?
Through the chair, Representative Rufford. So if you go onto our website, we actually posted our phase one study that we worked with BRG, and that does show our option that we've selected is a higher cost. The ability to spread that out over longer term contracts is important. But I think it's fair to say that if you were to look at the Harvest project, as it would need to be expanded for NSTAR, and the Glenfarne project, as we're looking at today, it's probably a little bit more expensive.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got a couple people in the queue. Representative Kopp, are you still?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, Mr. Sims, thank you for that eloquent presentation, sir. It's nice to have things laid out in a way that the legislature can understand it. Never underestimate our ignorance. I appreciate it. Question, can you walk us through again how the two projects differ, the Glenfarne project and the Harvest project, and how they impact the ratepayer? You likened it to a mortgage and being able to spread out the original capital cost and soften the rate shock, so to speak. Can you just walk us through that and how those two projects are different and how they're able to do that?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Kopp, thank you for that question. I'll stay on this slide because I think that helps highlight what would happen and why we view it as important, the project that we've selected. So you've got, I'm going to say, similar capital costs for either project. And, you know, admittedly on our report, one was higher than the other. I don't think substantial is fair, but I think definitely one was higher than the other in the report that we submitted. What's important is the long-term flexibility. So when you think about entering into a half a billion dollar contract, with infrastructure particularly, you are required, or it makes sense from a utility's perspective, to enter into a long-term contract to spread those costs out. And so I don't know what the cost would be for Harvest, but let's just look at the Glenfarne option and pick whatever year you want. Let's look at 2034. So you've got $2.82. That is the cost that is going to be borne and NSTAR will have to commit to on an annual basis for every molecule that we buy, whether we're buying it from import or not, right? So that $2.82 is, we're always going to be paying that because we have to meet our contract commitments. So we've contracted with an infrastructure company to build something and they need to get paid. That's what we're committing to do. The key difference and distinction is with NSTAR's contract with Glenfarne, when the AKLNG project comes down, that goes away. In the Harvest scenario, they have no ability, right, because they're not developing the AKLNG pipeline coming down. So commercially, the customer is still going to be required to pay that as the export project is sending gas out the door, if that makes sense. So from a long-term perspective, I want to make sure that we're taking advantage of AKLNG resources. If it's built, it might not be. But if it is, I don't want to have to continue to pay a cost that's unnecessary. And that's a stranded asset. The harvest facility becomes a stranded asset from a utility perspective. I'm paying for that, but I no longer need it. So that's why that commercial flexibility and that commercial potential was really important to NSTAR, and that's the long-term view. I could take the view that short-term, yes, that is the one I want. But if I want to take advantage of $5 gas when that pipeline comes down, and just for the record, I am a supporter, and I am bullish about that project. So if I want to take advantage of that $5 gas coming down the pipeline at the fullest extent, this is the path that I chose. And I think it makes the most sense.
Thank you.
Hey, Paul. Okay. Thank you. I want to just kind of put a pin in that because I'd like to get Mr. Colasa to come up here in just a second to probably respond or contribute some more information to that question. So that's not lost on me that there's probably more to the discussion we just had. But I do want to finish up any clarifying questions for Mr. Sims and NSTAR. So Representative Costello, did you have a comment?
I have two questions. Yep. Thank you. Mr. Sims, thank you for being here. It's good to see you. If FERC is the one, the entity that's approving the facilities, then is it true that it's really not up to you which project gets comes to fruition?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I think that's a great question. You know, I think the FERC absolutely could take a look at both projects. Let's say they're filed at the same time and say which one makes the most sense. So, you know, they are ultimately the regulator on which import project goes in and out or which one advances. They could also say there's a need for both. I don't know if that's likely, but that is a possible situation. So, yeah, it's a great question that should be asked, yeah.
Another question.
Follow-up, yep.
And thank you for being here. And aside from being here and your website, what are you doing to educate the ratepayer about the landscape that we're now looking at here?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Costello, that's a great question. So the wintertime is kind of when the flurry of trade associations and those types of meetings start. So we've already been asked actually this morning, hey, can you give the same presentation that you're planning on giving to House Energy to our group? And so that's the process that we're going to be going through. If you look at the same time last year, it was probably too early. We didn't have a lot of these kind of finer points nailed down. You try to thread the needle on informing the public with reasonable outcomes versus just sort of informing the public. But we have been presenting that BRG report and the information behind it on what the capital costs are going to be and the likely potential of rates since 2024. So we are very active, and I think it's critical, especially now as we look at what's coming in 2033, to be very honest about what rates are going to be. There is no silver bullet. We are going to have cost increases, full stop.
One final question.
Okay, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. In terms of your application before the RCA and the additional storage in Stinksa, how much storage are you asking for, and what is your timeline for when that docket is before you, if you know? And then also, once you're there before the RCA, do you have the flexibility to engage in discussions that go beyond just your request for additional storage?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Costello. So we filed that on January 12th. We asked for an expedited consideration of 45 days. What we have asked for is not the recovery of rates. We have asked for a predetermination of prudency. So, yes, NSTAR, it makes sense to go forward with this storage project. Once it's built, if we get approval from the commission, then we will go through the rate application process. We'll file what the final costs were with the commission, and they'll be able to say, okay, this was prudent, this was not prudent, and walk through that full rate process. As far as getting it online, there are a number of things that we're working on. So, you know, DNR obviously plays a critical role. AOGCC plays a critical role. There are a number of leases we have to get, and then project procurement. So,
okay, quick follow-up.
So it was my understanding that this was capacity that existed now that you wanted access to, but now it sounds like this is you are building out additional capacity.
Through the chair, yes. Sorry, I didn't answer your question, Representative Costello. So this is a brand-new storage facility. It has the capacity for working gas, which is the gas that we can actually move in and out, of about 17 BCF. So you put that in addition to the 11 that we already have at Stinksa. That's 28 additional BCF, a total of storage capacity. And then it has the flexibility to provide significant deliverability that we will need, not only for an LNG import scenario, but also for a scenario where we're continuing to utilize Cook Inlet gas beyond 2033. So this is required.
Great, thank you. Anyway, you want to follow up on anything right now?
Just a quick one.
Okay, Representative Mayors.
Thank you. Just have a parallel question about FERC. So Glenn Fern was in Juneau last week, but I don't think this was discussed in any committee or anything. So my understanding is that is a modification to a FERC license that already exists as well to be able to do the import. Are you able to?
Co-Chair Mears, that is my understanding of what would have to happen for that project. They're the project developer, so I'm going to defer all those questions to them.
So we all understand that, but we don't know.
Okay. Good. Well, Mr. Kloss, if you'd like to come back up again, I am going to exercise some privilege here, though, to kind of steer things in a couple directions initially as we begin some more discussion here. I want to first go back to the balcony a little bit on this issue, and then we'll come back in a little bit more to the project comparison that I know we kind of left open. And I do want to come also back to the question about RCA could bring us together to talk, and I want to get to that. So I've kind of got three things queued up right now. But the first point I want to get, and I'd like both of you to help me with this, because if we go back a year ago, the concern over Cook Inlet gas was, from my perception, kind of the top energy issue. We could talk about a whole bunch of different things, but if we didn't get clear on a straight, confident path to providing gas for the Cook Inlet Rail Belt area, everything else didn't quite matter. And we started asking a lot of questions, and we got a lot of this's and that's, and they can do this, and we can't do this, and confidentiality. That provided a lot of obfuscation in terms of what is really going on, and do we have a direct path to giving our ratepayers and our residents clear confidence that their homes are going to stay warm and their lights are going to turn on. So I'm trying to get clear, and you provided some information at the beginning of your presentation about this issue. If we go back a year ago, we saw some clear gas shortage concerns in 2027. And more recently, we've seen a couple presentations through DNR that suggests that primarily because of the benefit of gas storage, we've now seen some new runway in the situation that, combined with also success of drilling, suggests that we're in better shape than we were a year ago. We have some confidence now in how to manage the gas we can produce, how to store it, and how to manage its use. And you've challenged that in terms of saying, things are a little more dire than that assertion that I started off with, suggesting that maybe we're in a little better place. But on the other hand, as you first, Mr. Sims suggested that things are much more dire, and you've called the governor and, the sky is falling. You also said in your presentation that, that you need gas in 2033. So that, to me, kind of rolled out, okay, well, that's 7 years from now. That doesn't sound so bad. And in your last slide, you said you're anticipating your gas demand will be met until 2029 when this project is done. So everything's okay. So help us, help me understand, how do we get to clarity on what needs to happen, who's going to get it done, and what role we can play, if any, to make sure that our residents are going to have gas, or if there's something that needs to happen, that we know what it is and we know how to make sure it happens. Because where I'm at today is I'm kind of left once again a year later with, we just don't know. And we've got multiple projects spinning around, and I don't know whether those multiple projects are a good thing. I like competition. I'm a capitalist. Or are multiple projects going to leave us confused and not acting, because we're waiting for one project to happen because it's so big and glorious, but maybe we'll do another project, but then we've got a competing one because we don't want to do that one, we'll do this one. So I'd like both of you to kind of help us understand, what's the path forward here to get this job done?
Yeah, I'll start with Co-Chair Holland. So there are a lot of complications with this challenge that we have.
You're starting off with my question.
The hardest one is that all of the utilities are on a different time frame. So, you know, if all of us had gas supply under contract and we were confident that the producers were going to meet their obligations, we could all get behind one project. But I think what you heard a couple of years ago, or maybe it was last year in session, when Chugach made the announcement they're going with Harvest, they were going with Harvest because our project couldn't come online until 2029, and they needed gas by 2028. And so when you start looking at these things, there are entities that have an obligation to serve, and then there are other developers of projects. Utilities have the obligation to serve. So we have to have the resources in place, lined up, planned out, so we can minimize the impact to customers. Chugach has that same obligation. They have to meet the needs of their customers, and their timeline is a lot more aggressive than ours is. So they made the decision independently to go with Harvest, which is not a bad decision for that utility. I think the question is, you know, again, they're a very reliable operator. They know what they're doing. The question is, how do we, if we want to do what's in the best interest of the state of Alaska, how do we get everybody on the same timeline? And so I think that's the biggest challenge that we have as a state, is understanding those timelines, understanding the potential solutions to fill the gap, to meet them.
Awesome.
Yes, to the chair, appreciate the question. You know, really, for the last couple of years, this has been very transparently stated, you know, in terms of where gas supply is ultimately going versus what the demand is. The particulars may change, but I think the key thing, as Mr. Sims indicated through his testimony, decisions need to be made so that infrastructure can be built and that it can be done efficiently for the ratepayers. And I think, you know, from our perspective, as indicated, lower capital cost, and would welcome the opportunity to have additional conversations with NSTAR. But ultimately, we feel that this is the best, the quickest, the most cost-efficient solution to address those near-term needs and to make sure that we provide the flexibility going forward. You know, different kinds of constructs or different lengths of terms, all of those are open for negotiation at every time. And so we're here to make sure that we provide a solution. We think we've got the best solution in place because of the existing infrastructure that we can reutilize, and we're ready to address those challenges.
Thank you. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. So thinking about when we need things, there's a DNR presentation of resources on Friday that's, I think, also been around, you know, showing that runway looks a little different than we thought a couple of years ago, but also understanding some of these, you know, real supply challenges. The floating storage unit brought up that old chestnut, that of the floating regasification units. And since demand starts small to begin with, and knowing that large projects can have events that take their timelines later, what is the practicality and, you know, potential costs of bringing in a smaller temporary solution like that if we do get waylaid with a larger construction project? Can I start?
Sure. Yeah. You know, to the chair, for us, we haven't looked at some of those more recently. We really believe that, again, with our brownfield construction, that the opportunity we have to be able to bring this online within the timeline can be very easily managed. Our scope is not as significant as a full greenfield project, so we feel that we can manage it within that timeline very effectively.
Co-Chair Mears, just really quick, one of the biggest challenges, again, going back to the timing, is it's a really hard decision, and NSTAR understands the impact. But, you know, the moment you make the decision to go with imports, you've essentially killed the Cook Inlet market from a production perspective. And so we have really tried to work with the producers that are existing there, Bluecrest and Fury, to continue to allow them to invest in the state of Alaska. We understand the importance that has on the Kenai Peninsula, just, you know, from that perspective. And so this is one of the challenges. You know, we know that there's more production there than we had a couple of years ago. So some of the things that we're doing, they're working. The challenge is there is no producer today, as I mentioned, that can meet the long-term needs when it gets to the 60 BCF. So again, going back to the timing question, how long do we kind of allow this market to exist? We want it to exist as long as possible. We're trying to extend contracts so that it can exist for the longest time possible. But the ultimate reality is at some point it's just not going to meet the market needs, and we need to address that.
Okay, follow up?
Thank you. So Mr. Sims, just to clarify, I mean, are there sort of small little options that might be able to carry through? I know, I'm sure that you've looked at a lot of that.
We're through the chair, Co-Chair Mears, we're trying to fill some of the gaps that we see, for example, in 2026. But also when you talk about timing, you know, MEA was able to get a 1-year extension for 4 BCF of gas, I think it was, or 6 BCF for their utility. But then after 2029, they have no gas under contract. So what can we do with Cook Inlet Gas to maybe meet that need? Homer Electric still has needs. Chugach Electric, as we know and we've talked about, still has needs in 2029, 2030. So is there a way we can leverage Cook Inlet production to get to where everybody's on the same timeline of 2033? It then makes this decision a lot easier and a lot more beneficial for customers. The challenge is, can we work together? Can the producers reliably deliver what they commit to? So meaning, can we get a firm contract that we can actually bank on? Right now, they're not willing to do that. We've got interruptible contracts. Can we get the storage in place that's going to be critical for the Cook Inlet market so we can pre-buy some of that gas, put it into storage, and use it in later years? We're trying to do all those things, but at some point, we might just have to say we need to go with the imported solution.
Okay, thanks. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Holland. Sorry, I had an initial question and then you started talking, and I have a whole bunch of other questions. I want to get to a math question, but first, you said something that I don't understand. You said once you go to imports, you have killed the Cook Inlet gas market. I don't understand that statement. Imports seem to be at a higher cost than having gas produced in the Cook Inlet Basin. From what I can tell, the price of that gas produced in the Cook Inlet Basin is still going to be lower than imports. How do we kill the Cook Inlet market with an import of gas?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, if you're looking to invest, you know, significant dollars, and the producers are putting significant dollars into their assets and into their planning for future years, if we build an import facility, volume matters. And so there may be some pricing that we can do with producers where we say, okay, we're on the hook for that $2.80 regardless of what we do now. So your contract is going to have to be what you would be receiving normally minus $2.80 to make it on par. So it's a tough decision for a producer to say, okay, I know my market is getting smaller because now there's imports. I know the value that I'm getting for this gas has now gotten smaller because they're paying for the infrastructure anyway. So do I continue to make that investment, or do I put it someplace else? I think that's a real risk.
Well, follow up, okay. You brought up the $2.80, so I just need to go through a little bit of math in my own head because I think I'm doing it right, but to Representative Mears' point, I got to check. So on slide 5 of your presentation, that's the $2.80 terminal fee. That's estimated per MCF, correct?
So, yeah, that's dependent on the volumes that are going through the terminal.
Okay. So let's just do quick, easy math. Let's say we have to import 60 BCF at some point. Please help me understand, because I'm not a gas guy. I think I know the answer. How many MCF are in 60 BCF?
Well, you could back that out. I don't have a calculator. But take the 60 BCF and divide it by the 365, and that'll get you your daily volume that's going through there. that's based on the numbers that are presented are based on the daily volume. So that's correct. how we backed into that. And I'm okay at math. I'm not that good where I can do that one in my head. So.
I'm just asking for a simple conversion, and there's one reason. I'm trying to figure out if you're charging $2.82 estimated per MCF, how much does that generate in dollars for a terminal fee per year?
I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, ultimately, what that's doing is that is recovering the cost plus rate of return over a certain period.
Okay. My math showed me, and this is why I want to make sure I'm right and not wrong, that it's a few hundred million a year in terminal fee.
That is pretty close. So what we pay Hilcorp today is over $250 million a year today. What we pay Fury per month last month is about $10 million a month. So the cost of gas is expensive.
But this is not the cost. Sorry, through the chair. This is not the cost of gas I'm talking about. This was the terminal fee that was offsetting the cost of the investment.
The cost of the commodity.
And infrastructure.
Excuse me. Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Refridge. The cost of the commodity that we pay today is the infrastructure cost that the producers are putting in. So they're investing dollars into wells and compression and all those things. So it is a recovery of their investment that they've made.
Sorry, one more follow-up to that. Because the investment that's happening from a producer perspective is the constant hunt for gas. If you build a piece of infrastructure, that has a fixed cost, and you don't have to go find it anymore. So wouldn't logic say that once you pay off the infrastructure, the terminal fee should go away? And if it's a couple hundred million a year, wouldn't you pay off your infrastructure in a short period of time because you're not searching for new wells?
Through the chair, Representative Rufford, so this is how the financing aspect works. When you buy a home, for example, the interest that you're paying over time can sometimes be more than the actual principal. So you see how that principal works down at a very, very small and unfortunate and frustrating amount per year as you pay that off. So it's a similar concept. You've got the cost of debt, you've got the cost of the return, all those things factor in to what's ultimately called the revenue requirement. Now we're really getting into the weeds here.
Yeah, I was going to say, on rate making. But finish up here and move on a little bit. So go ahead and finish your comment but we're getting a little deep here.
What you're seeing there is essentially the cost of interest and inflation and all those things tied into it. And the best example I can give is that of a mortgage where you're not actually working off the principal significantly over time.
Okay, thanks. Do you have a follow-up on that? Actually, let me pause here and ask Mr. Klasa, just in fairness, do you want to weigh in on this issue? I don't want to get too deep into the calculations and the conversions of MCSs to BCS, but we're talking fundamentally, I think, about an issue that's important between the two projects to understand what's going on. So any comment you want to make there just to keep this level?
Yeah, to the chair, I'm an engineer, so I enjoy these kinds of conversations. but I think, you know, I'll restate a couple of things, you know, that we have said throughout. You know, our ability to bring on, you know, LNG imports quickly at the lowest capital, lowest impact to ratepayers, we stand ready to do that.
Okay, thank you for that. Representative Kopp, did you have a question or comment you wanted to make before we go to the RCA?
Just two comments. One, I appreciate everything that Hilcorp has done to develop and find gas and bring more gas online for the state. Secondly, I recognize that Mr. Sims' comment about possibly killing the gas exploration industry in Cook Inlet is well taken. Someone who grew up there. You're also talking about the jobs, the labor, the workforce that work for all those companies that do exploration. You're giving up hope that what the geologists say is that there's a TCF out there that we can still find, and you're kind of putting up the white flag, and you're saying we're done with that part of the industry. And so it is a sea change, and I recognize, Mr. Sims, what you were saying. It's an absolute sea change to the community, to the workforce, and it's just a different model. But it's a profound change, and it's going to affect hundreds of families. So I appreciate you saying that.
Great. Thanks. I'd like to come back to the observation that Mr. Sims made that perhaps there's an opportunity for the RCA to bring all the players into the room, perhaps a white padded room with no windows, but nonetheless to, you know, encourage some more direct communications to work out some of these differences. And I'm wondering if Chair Espindola or Commissioner DeVries is still online and available, if you might respond to, I'm not sure if that would be an invitation or a suggestion, to the role that RCA might play in helping us move along with some of the decisions and this process to bring more clarity to the projects and some decisiveness to what needs to happen. Are either of you still on and able to respond to that?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Holland, this is Chair Espindola from the RCA. Yes, we have a public meeting tomorrow, and I will definitely bring this topic up for discussion amongst us commissioners.
Thank you for that. Anything, Mr. Sims or Ms. Kloss, you'd like to suggest? Well, it sounds like maybe you have the ear right now of the chair in terms of that conversation and discussion that might happen tomorrow that you'd like to frame in terms of what might happen if you were to get people together.
Co-Chair Holland, so I think what's really important is, you know, and you know, Harvest referenced it as far as clarity on the regulatory process. They will have to submit something in front of the commission in order for utilities to recover that cost in rates, like full stop. Right, that has to happen, regardless of what happens on the permitting side, on the FERC side. In order for a utility to recover costs in rates, they have to get something approved by the commission. And so clarity on this is a really critical point. And that's why I think both Jugach and NSTAR are very interested in not necessarily a decision-making process, because I think as they highlighted, they can't necessarily do that unless there's been a filing. But for them to get an understanding, a foundation of what is being considered by the utilities, I think is really important. And so that could help them inform their decisions as they're presented with these filings. It's important to put us all in the same room, understand demand, understand potential supply, understand that you know, you have a very reliable operator who's presenting a very good project. Is it the right one, or is the one that NSTAR is proposing, which is similar, has a more long-term view and more bullish view of the state of Alaska and maximizing Alaska resources? You know, what do we want to do as a state? And so that's, I think, a critical question. And one that the commission could help, you know, help guide. Again, it's not necessarily a ruling that could come from that, but they could have a foundation.
Ms. Kloss, any thoughts on what you'd like to see from the RCA in a potential discussion that would be helpful to the decisions that are ahead of us?
To the chair, yeah, I will say this. You know, again, I think that, you know, our project does offer a lot of different flexibilities, even as, you know, additional production may come online. But at the end of the day, we need our customers to be able to have, you know, their contracts approved. And so we support anything that gives them clarity so that we can move forward.
Okay, very good. Other questions? Yeah, Mr. Sims.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Just wanted to offer up one more opportunity for not just this committee, but for any legislators that are listening or are going to be listening. NSTAR is happy to sit down. And I would bring some experts who actually know those numbers a little bit better than I do, Representative Ruffridge, so you can get some answers to those questions. But I think that's really important to understand the numbers that are being presented, why they're at the cost that they are. And our staff and myself, we're happy to meet with any legislators individually and walk you through the numbers on how those are calculated.
Great. Thank you. And I can't help to bring up in the couple minutes we have left kind of the elephant in the room, which is a pipeline project. And I'm wondering if, you know, the two of you might give us some thoughts on your view of this project and how it's moving ahead, what steps may still be in store in terms of RCA approvals necessary for those contracts, because this project keeps both being exciting and attractive, but it also keeps getting in the way of getting other projects to move ahead, because some of these things don't make sense if there's a big pipeline and it's going to make gas in a couple of years. I'd appreciate any perspective the two of you have on where are we, what will help move this forward so that we don't find ourselves just spinning around waiting for another decision that comes another year later and we've not made any more progress. So if you want to start first.
Sure. Yeah. To the chair, again, our LNG import project, we feel, is very compatible with a gas line being developed. We don't think it precludes it at all. We are not participating in any aspect of the gas line as a Harvest entity.
Right. Thank you for that. Mr. Sims, anything you want to add?
Co-chair Holland, so NSTAR is in the middle of negotiations with Glenfarne. I think that was publicized and announced. We are working on an umbrella agreement. So that has sort of key terms, definitions, and then concurrently negotiating two agreements underneath that. One is the LNG import project, and the other is the pipeline project. And so our intent is to file that with the commission as a gas sales agreement. Again, we think it's important that the commission approve what I believe is a decision that shouldn't just be made by John Sims, but should be made by the state. And it allows the flexibility and the commercial, let's say, eloquence to transition from one project to another. And I'll say it again, the AKLNG project is the only project that has the potential to reduce the cost of energy. Full stop.
Okay, thanks. So this kind of brings us full circle, and I'm curious if, again, Chair Espindola might weigh in on this. As I understand the discussions about gas supply contracts with the LNG project, that there's going to be a certificate of public convenience, as well as potentially some gas contracts language approved by RCA. And I'm trying to understand where that is at and how does that interface then with these LNG import discussions going on, and how does this come together at the RCA in terms of there being a rational, cohesive look at these decisions versus sticking all of them in separate silos and not seeing those made? So I'm wondering, Chair Espindola, if you've got any thoughts on how you'll manage this process of these different discussions, and you know, how do you get to a certificate of public convenience when you have these other projects that is in essence provide the supply of gas that would seem to make the two incompatible, and yet we want something to move ahead. Chair?
Yeah, for the record, John Espindola, RCA, through the co-chair Holland. So I'm actually going to defer back to Mr. Sims. I think he just spoke to the mechanism that this filing would come before us. And I don't want to speak for Mr. Sims, but I understood him to say that NSTAR would be filing a gas sales agreement that would capture the both phases, phase one and phase two of the AKLNG pipeline.
Okay. Anything further on that? Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Sims. Mr. Klasse, thank you for joining us today and braving the weather. If that affected your travels, I wish you safe travels getting home. And thank you again for being here. And to Chair Espindola and Commissioner DeRees, if you're still there, thank you for joining us online at this point. So thank you for all of this time we've had and the questions. We need to conclude the presentations. The House Energy Committee will meet this coming Thursday, January 29th. There we'll hear introductions of House Bill 252 and House Bill 259. On Tuesday, February 3rd, we'll be holding public testimony for House Joint Resolution 27 that we heard in our last meeting. We are making an amendment deadline for House Joint Resolution 27 for Monday, February 2nd at noon. And we'll follow up with some communication to everybody on the committee, just reiterating those dates and that schedule. And therefore, seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:57 p.m. Thank you.